A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a good one. He's asking about the revival of Hebrew as a spoken language. Specifically, when did it actually cross the line from being this engineered, still settling project into a living, breathing national language that had a life of its own? What was that tipping point? And what was it like during that weird in-between period when the vocabulary, the syntax, the pronunciation were still being hammered out in real time?
This is one of those topics where the more you dig, the stranger it gets. Because we're talking about the only truly successful large-scale language revival in recorded history. Nobody else has done this. Cornish is trying, Manx is trying, but Hebrew is the one that actually pulled it off.
Which is wild when you think about it. A language that had been effectively dead as a spoken mother tongue for something like 1700 years, and now there are toddlers in Tel Aviv arguing about snacks in it.
And the question of the tipping point, it's not one clean moment. It's more like a cascade of thresholds. But if I had to put a rough bracket on it, I'd say the critical mass moment was somewhere between 1914 and 1925. By the early 1920s, you had the first generation of children who were native Hebrew speakers being born in Palestine, and that changed everything.
Let's back up a little. Because most people know the name Eliezer ben Yehuda and the broad strokes, he moved to Jerusalem. He insisted on speaking only Hebrew at home. He basically drove everyone around him insane. But the actual mechanics of what he was doing are way more interesting than the folkero version.
They really are. Ben Yehuda arrived in Jaffa in 1881. At that point, Hebrew was used for prayer, for rabbinic correspondence, for poetry. But nobody was ordering groceries in it. Nobody was telling their spouse to take out the trash. The vocabulary for daily life simply didn't exist. There's a famous story that Ben Yehuda's wife, Devorah, couldn't ask for a cup of coffee in Hebrew because the word for coffee hadn't been standardized yet. She'd have to point.
The linguistic equivalent of charades.
So Ben Yehuda's first move was to start building the dictionary. He'd get up at 4 in the morning, work on word lists for hours, then go about his day. He coined hundreds of words from biblical roots. Glida for ice cream, from a root meaning frost. Reykjavik for train, from a root meaning to ride. Ofek for horizon. These seem obvious now, but they had to be invented by somebody.
He wasn't working in a vacuum. There were other people pushing for Hebrew revival before him and alongside him. The Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment movement, had already been producing secular Hebrew literature for decades.
That's a crucial point. People sometimes imagine Ben Yehuda single-handedly resurrected a dead language, but he was standing on a foundation. The Maskilim, the Enlightenment writers, had been publishing Hebrew newspapers and novels since the early 1800s. The first Hebrew novel, Ahavat Tiyan, by Abraham Mapu, came out in 1853. It's a biblical romance, but it proved you could write modern narrative in Hebrew. By the time Ben Yehuda showed up, there was already a small but real Hebrew reading public.
The reading public existed. The speaking public did not.
And bridging that gap required a kind of fanaticism that most people are not capable of. Ben Yehuda's son, Itamar, was born in 1882, and Ben Yehuda made the decision. This child would hear only Hebrew. No Yiddish, no Russian, no Arabic. Just this language that had no native speakers, no children's songs, no lullabies. Devorah apparently had to sit in a dark room and cry silently so Itamar wouldn't hear her speaking Russian.
That's not language revival. That's a linguistic hostage situation.
It gets worse. Itamar didn't speak until he was 4 years old. His parents were terrified he was developmentally disabled. And then one day, Ben Yehuda came home and found Devorah singing a Russian lullaby to the child, and he lost it, started shouting, smashed a table. The story goes that Itamar, startled, blurted out his first words in Hebrew, "Father, why are you shouting?"
That can't possibly be true.
It's almost certainly embellished, but the core facts are documented. Itamar ben Zivi, as he was later known, did have severely delayed speech, and he did eventually become one of the first native Hebrew speakers in nearly 2 millennia. He grew up to be a linguist himself.
You've got this one family, this one experiment, in the 1880s. That's not a revival, that's a curiosity. When does it actually start to scale?
The scaling happens in three overlapping phases. Phase 1 is the first aliyah, roughly 1882 to 1903. About 25,000 Jews come to Palestine, mostly from Russia and Romania. They're not all ideological about Hebrew. A lot of them are speaking Yiddish or Russian, but they create the conditions. Agricultural settlements start forming, and in those settlements, Hebrew begins to be the common language between groups that don't share another tongue.
The practical argument. We don't have a choice. We have to speak something.
Phase 2 is the second aliyah, 1904 to 1914. About 40,000 more immigrants, and these ones are much more ideological. Young socialist Zionists, many of them, who see Hebrew as part of the national project. In 1906, the Herzliya Hebrew Gymnasium opens in Jaffa, the first Hebrew language high school. By 1913, the so-called War of the Languages breaks out.
The War of the Languages. That sounds like a Monty Python sketch.
It was a real crisis. The Technion, which was being founded in Haifa, announced that its language of instruction would be German. The Hilfsverein der Deutschen Juden, the German Jewish aid organization, was funding it, and they argued that German was the language of science. Hebrew didn't have the technical vocabulary yet. The Zionist movement erupted. Teachers walked out, students protested, and eventually, the Technion backed down and agreed to teach in Hebrew. That was a huge symbolic victory. It established the principle that Hebrew wasn't just for prayer and poetry. It was for engineering, for physics, for everything.
By the time we hit World War I, you've got schools, you've got newspapers, you've got ideological commitment. But I'm still not convinced you've got a living language. You've got a project.
That's exactly the right distinction. And this is where we get to the actual tipping point. The British take control of Palestine in 1907, and in 1922, the Mandate recognizes Hebrew as an official language alongside English and Arabic. That's the political seal. But the real shift is demographic. In 1914, there were maybe a few hundred people in Palestine who spoke Hebrew as their primary language. By the early 1920s, you start getting the first cohort of children who are raised in Hebrew from birth. Not just the Ben Yehuda experiment, but hundreds, then thousands of kids in the growing cities and kibbutzim.
Those kids are the tipping point.
They are absolutely the tipping point, because children don't learn a language the way adults do. Adults can be ideologically committed to speaking Hebrew, but their Hebrew is going to be stilted, influenced by their native languages, full of calques and awkward constructions. Kids don't care. Kids just talk. And when enough kids are talking to each other in Hebrew on the playground, the language starts to breathe. It starts to develop the thing linguists call native speaker intuitions. The unspoken rules about what sounds right and what sounds wrong that no textbook can teach.
The difference between knowing the grammar and feeling the grammar.
And this is where the language starts breaking out into its own thing, which is the second part of the prompt. What was it like when Hebrew was developing its own momentum? The answer is messy, creative, and incredibly fast.
Give me examples. What actually changed?
Pronunciation, for one. Ben Yehuda had advocated for a Sephardic pronunciation, the vowel system used by Jews from the Middle East and North Africa, as opposed to the Ashkenazic pronunciation used by European Jews. He thought it sounded more authentic, closer to the biblical original, and he largely won that battle. Modern Hebrew uses the five-vowel Sephardic system, but the consonants didn't all follow. The guttural consonants ayin, chet, resh, which are pronounced in the throat in traditional Sephardic Hebrew, got softened or lost entirely under the influence of European speakers who couldn't produce them.
You've got a Sephardic vowel system with Ashkenazic consonants.
It's a compromise nobody planned. It just emerged from who was speaking and what they could pronounce. And the same thing happened with syntax. Biblical Hebrew is what linguists call a VSO language, verb, subject, object. Ate the man the apple. Modern Hebrew shifted to SVO, subject, verb, object. The man ate the apple. That shift happened because most of the early speakers were native speakers of European languages that use SVO. Their brains defaulted to that order, and their kids picked it up.
That's fascinating. The deep structure of the language changed, not just the surface vocabulary.
Vocabulary is the most visible part. the Language Committee, the precursor to the Academy of the Hebrew Language, was founded in 1890 by Ben Yehuda and others, and they were churning out neologisms at an incredible rate. Some of them stuck, some of them didn't. Ben Yehuda coined something like 300 new words himself. The committee published word lists for everything: carpentry terms, agricultural terms, clothing, cooking, and people would actually use them. There are stories of teachers standing in front of their classes with the latest word list, drilling the students on the new vocabulary for the week.
It was top-down and bottom-up simultaneously.
And the bottom-up part is where the real life of the language comes from. Because once you have native-speaking children, they start doing what children everywhere do. They innovate. They create slang. They mix words. They develop playground rules that have nothing to do with the language committee. By the 1930s and 40s, you have a generation of young people in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and the kibbutzim who are not speaking revived Hebrew, they're just speaking Hebrew, the language of their lives.
That's the moment the prompt is really asking about, right? The transition from engineered language to organic language.
I'd say the critical window is roughly 1925 to 1948. By 1925, the Hebrew University opens in Jerusalem, and Hebrew is the language of instruction. By the early 30s, you've got a thriving Hebrew press, Devar, Haaretz, Yedioth Ahronoth, Hebrew theater, Hebrew poetry. Bialik is writing. Chernikovsky is translating Homer into Hebrew, which is a flex, by the way, translating the foundational text of Western literature into a language that had no native speakers a generation earlier.
Then the state is founded in 1948, and at that point, Hebrew is the de facto national language. The question's already settled.
It's settled, but not stable. Here's a number that blows my mind. In 1948, the Jewish population of Palestine was about 650,000. Over the next 3 years, the population doubled. 700,000 immigrants arrived from Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East. Most of them didn't speak Hebrew. The state had to run Upanim, intensive Hebrew schools for adults, just to get the new arrivals functional, and the language kept absorbing. Words from Arabic, from Yiddish, from Russian, from German, from English. By the 1960s, you've got a fully natural, fully modern language with all the messiness that implies.
The open system is actually a fascinating piece of this, because it's not just teaching a language, it's enforcing a specific version of that language. The Academy of the Hebrew Language is still doing this. They issue rulings on new words. They try to coin Hebrew equivalents for English loanwords.
They lose as often as they win. They tried to get people to say cacique instead of spaghetti. Nobody says cacique. They tried to push sakra alk for overdraft. People just say overdraft with a Hebrew accent. The Academy is the linguistic equivalent of a parent trying to get teenagers to stop using slang. They mean well, but the language has its own life now.
That's actually the proof that Hebrew made it. When the official language authority can't control what people actually say, you've got a real living language. A dead language doesn't resist. It doesn't develop slang. It doesn't borrow words the Academy disapproves of.
Modern Hebrew is absolutely teeming with this. There's a whole layer of Arabic-derived slang, sababa for cool, yalla for let's go, akla for great, walla for wow or really. These words are so deeply embedded that most Israeli Hebrew speakers don't even think of them as foreign. They're just Hebrew now. And the grammar has evolved in ways that would make a biblical grammarian weep. The verb system has simplified. The object marker et, which is one of the most distinctive features of Hebrew grammar, gets dropped in casual speech all the time.
Can you give me a concrete example of how the grammar has shifted? Something a biblical Hebrew speaker would find jarring.
Biblical Hebrew has a complex system of verb forms that encode not just tense but aspect, whether an action is completed or ongoing. Modern Hebrew flattened most of that. The consecutive vav construction, where the word and flips the tense of a following verb from past to future, or vice versa. That's basically gone in spoken Hebrew. It survives in formal writing, but nobody talks like that. If you went back in time and spoke modern Hebrew to a biblical Israelite, they'd understand a lot of the vocabulary, but they'd think your grammar was broken.
Which raises an interesting question. How much of modern Hebrew is actually Hebrew, and how much is a European language wearing Hebrew vocabulary?
That's a question linguists argue about constantly. The Israeli linguist Gilad Zuckerman has made a career out of arguing that modern Hebrew, he calls it Israeli, is a hybrid language, fundamentally shaped by Yiddish and other European languages. He points to things like the phrase ma nishma, which means what's up or how are you, and notes that it's a direct calque of the Yiddish vos hert zik. A biblical Hebrew speaker would not say that. They wouldn't even recognize the idiom.
You have an entire layer of the language that is Yiddish thinking in Hebrew words.
And another layer that's Russian thinking, another that's Arabic thinking, another that's English thinking. The language is a palimpsest. But here's the thing. That's true of every living language. English is a Germanic language with a Romance vocabulary and a grammar that's been stripped down by centuries of contact with Norse and French. Nobody says English isn't English. At some point, the hybrid becomes the thing itself.
The Creole becomes the language.
And the moment that happens is the moment the prompt is asking about. When did Hebrew stop being a project and start being a language? I think you can point to specific markers. The first Hebrew language love letter written by a teenager who didn't know any other language. The first Hebrew joke that only works in Hebrew, not a translated joke, but one that depends on Hebrew wordplay. The first Hebrew curse word that came from the street, not from a committee.
When did Hebrew get its first really good swear words?
That is actually a legitimate linguistic milestone, and the answer is probably the 1930s and 40s, with the emergence of the Palmach generation, the young people in the pre-state military units and kibbutzim. They developed a whole slang lexicon, much of it earthy. They borrowed from Arabic, they invented compounds, they repurposed biblical words in crude ways. That's when Hebrew got a pulse.
There's something almost poignant about that. A language that spent nearly 2,000 years being used for prayer and scripture, and the sign that it's truly alive again is that teenagers are using it to be vulgar.
The sacred becoming profane is the proof of life. And you see it in the literature, too. Agnon, who won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1966, wrote in a Hebrew that's deeply strange. He was born in Galicia in 1888, grew up speaking Yiddish, and his Hebrew prose has this dreamlike, almost archaic quality. He's pulling from rabbinic sources, from Hasidic tales, from his own invented compounds. He's not writing the Hebrew of the street, but he's also not writing the Hebrew of the prayer book. He's creating something new, and it works because by the time he's writing his major works in the 40s and 50s, there's a readership that can handle it.
The literary Hebrew and the spoken Hebrew are diverging almost from the start.
Yes, and that's healthy. That's what living languages do. They develop registers. You don't talk to your boss the way you talk to your spouse. You don't write a poem the way you write a grocery list. The existence of multiple registers, formal, informal, literary, technical, slang, is one of the strongest indicators that a language is fully alive.
Let's talk about the moment when Hebrew started producing things that weren't possible before. The first Hebrew pop song, the first Hebrew film dialogue that didn't sound stilted.
The first Hebrew feature film was probably Oded the Wanderer in 1933, but the dialogue is very declamatory. It sounds like people reciting rather than talking. The real breakthrough in naturalistic Hebrew film dialogue probably doesn't come until the 1960s with the Borica's films, comedies and melodramas about the ethnic tensions between Ashkenazi and Mizrahi Jews. Those films captured how people actually talked. The code switching, the accents, the slang. They're not high art, but linguistically they're a gold mine.
Code switching is actually a huge part of the Israeli linguistic experience. You hear Hebrew-Arabic-English mashups constantly.
It's not a bug. It's the feature. It's what happens when a language is confident enough to absorb freely. The early revivalists were purists. Ben Yehuda would reportedly switch to French rather than use a non-Hebrew word in conversation, which is its own kind of absurdity. But by the mid-20th century, the purism had loosened. People used what worked, and that's when Hebrew really became Israeli Hebrew rather than the Hebrew of the committees.
If I had to draw a line, and the prompt is asking for a line, I'd say the language was settling from roughly 1881 to 1920, achieved critical mass somewhere between 1920 and 1930, and was fully self-propelling by the time the state was founded in 1948. Does that track?
But I want to add one more layer, because there's something eerie about the whole thing. Hebrew didn't just revive. It revived into a completely different world than the one it died in. Biblical Hebrew was the language of a small, ancient Near Eastern kingdom. Modern Hebrew is the language of a 20th century nation-state with electricity and democracy and nuclear weapons. The vocabulary gap was staggering. The language committee and its successor, the Academy, had to coin words for electricity. Telephone, democracy, psychology, atom, oxygen, democracy. Every single one of those is a modern coinage built from ancient roots.
Electricity is kashmal, right? Which is a biblical word.
Kashmal appears exactly 3 times in the book of Ezekiel, and nobody knows what it meant. It's some kind of divine radiance. The word is used in the vision of the divine chariot. The translators of the Septuagint rendered it as electron, which is where we get the word electricity. So Ben Yehuda or someone on the committee looked at this obscure biblical word for a mysterious glowing thing and said, "That's electricity now," and it stuck.
That's a beautiful choice. Instead of just borrowing electricity and Hebraizing the pronunciation, they dug into the oldest layer of the language and repurposed a word for divine fire. That's not just translation, that's poetry.
It happened thousands of times. Sometimes it worked brilliantly. Sometimes it produced clunky monstrosities that nobody used. The word for computer, makshef, is a modern coinage from a root meaning to think or to calculate. That one worked. Everyone says makshev, but the Academy's word for to update, adken, faces constant competition from the English-derived lapdet. In casual speech, most people say lapdet.
The Academy is fighting a rearguard action against English, and English is winning.
English is the global linguistic superpower, and Hebrew is a language spoken by about 9 million people. Of course English is winning, but here's what's interesting. Hebrew is not in danger. It's not like Irish, where English is slowly swallowing the native language. Hebrew has a nation-state behind it, a mandatory education system, a military, a media ecosystem. It's the language of the Knesset, the courts, the universities. It's not going anywhere. The question is just how much English it absorbs along the way.
That absorption is itself a sign of health. Languages that don't borrow are dead languages.
Latin doesn't borrow from English. Sanskrit doesn't borrow from Hindi. Living languages are promiscuous. They take words from anywhere and make them their own.
Let's circle back to the core of the prompt. What was it like in that in-between period? You've painted a picture of committees and word lists and playgrounds and slang, but what was the texture of daily life when the language was still half-formed?
There are wonderful accounts from the period. People describe conversations where you'd start a sentence in Hebrew, run out of vocabulary, switch to Yiddish or Russian or Arabic for a few words, then loop back to Hebrew. There were Hebrew police. Literally, students who were deputized to report on classmates who spoke other languages at school. The Herzliya Gymnasium had a rule, Hebrew only on campus. If you were caught speaking Yiddish, you'd be fined or shamed.
The linguistic equivalent of a hall monitor.
Deeply resented, probably, but also effective. By the 19-teens, there were children in Tel Aviv who were genuinely more comfortable in Hebrew than in their parents' languages. And that created a strange generational dynamic. Parents who couldn't fully express themselves to their own children. Children who corrected their parents' grammar.
That's a whole psychological novel right there.
There's a famous Israeli writer, Yehuda Amichai, who was born in Germany in 1924 and came to Palestine as a child. He wrote about how the Hebrew of his generation was a language, without a grandmother. No lullabies, no folk sayings, no inherited idioms. Everything had to be built from scratch. And there's a kind of loneliness in that, but also a kind of freedom. Nobody could tell you you were saying it wrong because there was no right yet.
A language without a grandmother. That's a haunting phrase.
It captures the whole thing in 6 words. Hebrew had parents, Ben Yehuda and the Maskilim and the teachers. But it didn't have grandparents. It didn't have the deep oral tradition that most languages inherit. That's what the last 100 years have built. The folk songs, the nursery rhymes, the idioms, the shared cultural references. Naomi Shemer songs, the jokes that every Israeli knows. That's the grandmother arriving, belatedly.
If the language achieved critical mass by the 1920s, the grandmother layer probably didn't really solidify until the 60s or 70s.
I'd say that's right. It takes a couple of generations of native speakers to build that deep cultural sediment. By the time you have Israeli-born grandparents telling stories to their grandchildren in Hebrew, the circle is closed. That probably happened on a mass scale in the 1970s and 80s.
Which means we're now in, what, the 4th or 5th generation of native Hebrew speakers. The language has a lived history that's older than most of its speakers' grandparents.
It's still changing fast. If you listen to recordings of Hebrew from the 1950s, news broadcasts, speeches, the accent is different, more guttural, more formal. The Hebrew of a 20-year-old in Tel Aviv today is not the Hebrew of David Ben-Gurion. The vowels are shifting, the sentence structure is getting more English-influenced, and the slang turns over every few years.
Which is exactly what you'd expect from a healthy language. The day Hebrew stops changing is the day it dies again.
That's not happening anytime soon.
Here's a thought to wrap up. The prompt asks about the tipping point, and I think we've identified it. That first generation of native-speaking children in the early 1900s, the ones who corrected their parents and developed their own slang and didn't have to think about which language they were speaking. But the deeper answer is that the tipping point isn't a single moment. It's a cascade. The political tipping point is 1922, when the mandate recognizes Hebrew. The demographic tipping point is the 1920s, when the first native-speaking cohort comes of age. The cultural tipping point is the 1940s and 50s, when you get a full Hebrew media and literary ecosystem. And the psychological tipping point is the 70s and 80s, when Hebrew-speaking grandparents start telling stories to Hebrew-speaking grandchildren. The language has been tipping for 100 years.
That's beautifully put. And I'd add one more. The linguistic tipping point is still happening. Every time the Academy of the Hebrew Language loses a battle to a loanword, every time a teenager coins a phrase that goes viral, the language is tipping further into its own life. The revival is not a past event. It's an ongoing process.
A language that spent 17 centuries in the library and the synagogue, and now it's ordering falafel and writing rap lyrics and arguing about politics on Twitter. If that's not a successful revival, I don't know what is.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The Selknam people of Tierra del Fuego believed that during a solar eclipse, the sun was being devoured by a giant celestial whale, and their shamans would perform an urgent ritual marriage ceremony between the moon and the sea to distract the whale and convince it to spit the sun back out.
I have so many questions about the guest list for that wedding. Our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, everybody. If you enjoyed this episode, find us at myweirdprompts.com for the full archive and show notes. This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.